My name is Laurie. I'm a compulsive overeater. Since I want to talk a bit about anonymity later on, I'll say that my name is Laurie Cherniak. And if you ever come to Winnipeg, I don't know why you would, except it's a lot of sun. You wouldn't find me by looking for Laurie. Well, actually, you might, because there are very few men named Laurie. But I'm very privileged to be here. I'm a little distracted by the sweater. Is it possible for me to? I'm very privileged to be here. Pasha said that I dissected things like an attorney. I don't consider that a compliment. I would rather. Yeah, it wasn't meant as one. I would rather be told that I dissected it as an English major, because that's what I have been. And I was trained in reading of texts, and I had some training in teaching of adults as well. Whatever my skills are, they've been learned. They haven't been, they're not God-given or anything. I just had a good education that allowed me to do some of this explication. But I sure don't... I don't think of myself as an expert as much as a person who redacts, who repeats the message that he's been given by a bunch of other people to whom I owe my recovery. Dr. Bob says, gives reasons for helping others. And I am going to refer to that book. But he gives his reasons for helping people. And he says, sense of duty. It is a pleasure. Because in so doing, I'm paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. Dr. Bob worked, he dealt with 5,000 alcoholics in a 12-year period before he died. I don't think I've done quite like that, but he had one man to thank, and that was Bill Wilson. I have 100,000 people to thank. So goodness knows I have even more of an obligation to carry this message, even than Bob, although I think he went far beyond me. He says, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. What I want to do today is talk about step 12 and its ramifications, because once we're in step 12, we're also into organization. Once we have to carry the message, we're into an area where to carry the message effectively, we ought to organize. And we have. Those compulsive eaters who have recovered have organized into an organization called Overeaters Anonymous, with all of its various parts and parcels, and the groups and the regions, and the intergroups and the regions, and the World Service. And we've done that for one primary purpose, to carry the message to the compulsive eater who still suffers. There are other 12-step groups dealing with food. Each one has its own particular approach to the issue, and God bless them, and God bless us. As long as eating problems, people with eating problems like us are helped, and as long as they recover, who cares how many there are? Who cares how anyone recovers? As long as there is recovery, we take no position on outside issues for a good reason. We are not necessarily the only path, and goodness knows, I've been to enough OA meetings where I would say, yes, that's right. We are not necessarily the only path. This isn't a path. I've been to lots of meetings where, and I've been responsible for some meetings that should have died. And I think I told you, did I tell you? Yeah, I told you yesterday the meeting I was responsible for should have died a year or two before it did, because I was hanging on to it. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to the compulsive eater who still suffered. I'm one of those, it's not a big book thumper who says that. It's a person who wants to emphasize by the result of these steps, that it is the absolute guarantee of this program that by the time we work the 12 steps, we will have had a spiritual awakening. And the big book makes clear that the spiritual awakening is not necessarily the hit in the eye, the hit on the forehead, bang, I've got this sudden conversion. It can be, and it usually is, according to the big book, an experience of suddenly of being able to realize after the fact that you've achieved a condition where you are in tune with your core beliefs, you're in tune with your inner self, and you no longer are insane when it comes to your particular addictive quality, the foods, in our case, the foods and the eating behaviors that cause your addiction, that cause your cravings. And that sense of that spiritual awakening is, in fact, the sanity that we came to believe in and was described in step two. That's the solution. We're sane. And as long as we keep sane, we don't eat. The big book says, and I know that many people in OA, and I understand that. Actually, I had a correspondence with A.G., who is such an incredibly great man. He always said, abstinence is the most important thing in my life without exception. And I knew he was a big book thumper, and I wrote to him. I said, the big book says that the most important thing in their lives, I'll quote it, it's from the We Agnostics, when many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. So the big book says the most important thing in the lives of people is the consciousness of recovered people is the consciousness of the presence of God. And I wrote to him, I said, what do you say to that? He said, I don't argue about these things. He says, one is the process, one is the end result. One is the ticket you buy, and one is the destination. And it's not really important. And I agree with that. For me, I don't worry about abstinence. For me, it's obvious. For me, I look to see what kind of food there is, and I don't eat food that I can't eat, because I know that if I eat it, it'll be poison. And what I emphasize, and I think, I know AG did this as well, what anyone emphasizes who has recovered is working the program in such a way that we keep on an even plane and that we've got the direct connection with our core values, our core inner beliefs, whether they're deeply religious or completely abstract like mine. We cannot rest. We have a disability, and that disability keeps us from resting. Because the disability that I have is that my body is different from normal people's. I cannot eat certain foods that they can eat. I also am abnormal in the sense that I have a mind that can get easily clouded. You know, the shadow is just that close to me. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows, right? It has the power to cloud men's minds, right? That's what the shadow has, yeah. And I see there's no one as old as I am in this room except... wasn't there a movie on the shadow? I thought there was, yeah. But my mind is easily clouded. And if I don't keep working, it will become clouded again. And what the clouding does is cloud over my ability to see the foods that I can't eat and tell me that I can eat those and give me every kind of excuse in the world that I can eat them, from the most ridiculous to the deepest. With this disability comes responsibilities. I mean, I wear glasses. I can't throw them away because I can't see without my glasses. And I acknowledge my disability, and I'm sane about that. You know, if I didn't have a leg, I would not... Well, actually, I have a disability that says I can't run a four-minute mile at my age. Well, I can never run a four-minute mile, but I mean, there are some people who can. I don't try to run a four-minute mile because I know I cannot run a four-minute mile. We all, in our normal lives, accept the limitations that our bodies place on us. Our problem is that our minds cannot accept that unless we keep them completely clean. And the message of our program is that 10, 11, and 12, and look, 10 says continued to do this, sought through prayer and meditation to improve, 11 says to improve. These are all continuing steps. Having had a spiritual awakening, we tried to carry this message. Those three steps are clearly the steps where we maintain the growth. Maintain the growth. That's right. I was going to say we maintain and grow, but no, maintain the growth. We have to keep growing or else we die. So for me, step 12 is absolutely essential. And if you... well. It's a given. I have to do it. I don't always like doing it, but at the same time, once I do it, I feel great. And that is the promise of this program as well. Remember how this program started, the 12-step program started. It didn't start when Bill Wilson recovered when he had his big flash, when he was on the mountaintop and the cool wind of God was going through him and he felt refreshed, and he calls on Dr. Silkworth, and Silkworth says, here's what just happened to me. I don't know. What, am I crazy? And Silkworth could have said, well, yeah, you've been 3 days without a drink. You came in here completely drunk, saying you found the answer, and you're just in withdrawal. You got the heebie-jeebies. You got the DTs. But Silkworth didn't say that. He said, whatever you have is better than what you had before. Keep it. And that was, Clancy gives a wonderful talk on the thin threads that bind OA together, AA together, and that's one of them. Silkworth could have said something completely different. But AA did not start in November of 1934 when Bill quit drinking. For 6 months, Bill tried to carry the message to other people, and he failed abysmally. People would come into his house. One guy committed suicide. One guy took a knife to Lois. One guy stole the fur coat, Lois's only fur coat. It was always Lois who suffered, you know. I mean, think about it. Lois was working, and then she came home, and she cleaned up, and she probably emptied the ashtrays, and she made the meals, and Bill just talked. I'm glad he talked. Anyway, after about 6 months, Bill had not converted a soul. Not one person had remained sober. And two things happened in his life. One of them I haven't found in the literature, but I know based on what people on what Lois has told people. It's not even in Lois's book, Lois Remembers. But I haven't been able to find any literature. But it is said, and Lois said she did this, that at one point Bill says to her, I haven't been able to keep one single person sober. And Lois said, yes, you have. You're sober. And the other thing that happened was that Bill was talking to Dr. Silkworth and saying, after about 6 months, I got to give this up. I can't do it. I haven't been able to capture a single soul. And Silkworth says, it's because you are going backwards. You're starting off with preaching. You're starting off with your wonderful conversion, how great you feel. You have no sense of identification. And this was, of course, the way Ebbie had brought the message to Bill. I've got religion, said Ebbie, and Ebbie started to talk about the Oxford groups and stuff. I won't go into that. Silkworth said, you got the cart before the horse. You've got to start focusing on the twin problems of the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, because that will make them hopeless enough to get what it is to do those ridiculous things. To do those ridiculous things that you know you have to do to recover. And Bill started taking that to heart. And then luck has it, some people think, other people think it was divinely inspired, but whatever. He finds himself alone in the Mayflower Hotel in May of 1935. And the bar is beckoning to him, and he says to himself, I could have a drink or two and no one would know. And fear grips him. And he says, I need to find another alcoholic to talk to. And he, you know, for those of you who remember, he phones 10 people. He phones, first of all, a reverend named Walter Tunks. And he says, I never knew why I called Mr. Tunks, Reverend Tunks. I think I had known someone with his name or with a similar name. And for me, it's always been Tunks, drunks, you know. But anyway, so he phones Tunks, and Tunks gives him the name of 10 people. And he phones those 10. He says, I'm a rum hound. This is Bill's language. I'm a rum hound from New York, member of the Oxford groups. I need to talk to another alcoholic. And he says, at first, Reverend Tunks wasn't sure whether it would be a good idea to have one alcoholic meet another alcoholic, because there'd be two drunk alcoholics. But he gave him the name of 10 people, and Bill phoned those people, and they were too busy, and they couldn't do it, or they were just about to leave, or one was writing a sermon. And, it was Saturday. No, it was Saturday. So he was writing a sermon for the next day. And they gave him, someone gave him a few other names. And one of them was the name of Henrietta Seiberling. Henrietta Seiberling, he didn't want to phone her because he thought she was the wife of the head of, Seiberling Tire Company, I think, a rubber company, whom he had met. And he didn't want to sort of embarrass himself by speaking to, the wife of this man whom he had known. But finally, there was that one name was left to him. So he phoned her, And she turned out to be the estranged daughter-in-law of the family who was living in the gatehouse of this huge estate in Akron. Now, her story, and I've heard her tell her story, and she wasn't that impressed by Bill Wilson, by the way. She always thought Bill over-dramatized this thing. But she had been trying to sober up a man everyone loved in Akron, Ohio, named Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob Smith. And Dr. Bob was a proctologist, which means he went in from behind, and a surgeon. And the thought of, you know, while he was drunk doing these operations has always sort of given me a kind of an empty feeling in certain parts of my anatomy. Especially given the state of surgery in 1935, too. But at any rate, he was a hopeless drunk. He would never admit it, and he had been a member of Oxford Groups. Now, the Oxford Groups were a group of people who had a very simple way of finding a spiritual awakening. And Ebby described it very simply to Bill. He said, well, you know, I said this, yes, you get honest with yourself, you get honest with another human being, you make amends and restitution for any harm you've done, you trust God, and you help others no matter without hope of reward or gain. Very, very simple program. Bob knew all this. Bob had been a member of the Oxford Groups for a year and a half. Henrietta was in the Oxford Groups. A whole bunch of people in Akron had been in the Oxford Groups. And they prayed and prayed for Dr. Bob. Finally, Henrietta actually tried to engineer something for Dr. Bob. She had a group of people all primed, and she said to Dr. Bob, we're setting up a group of people, and we will, in a very intimate group, confess our deepest sins. And they had this meeting, and people confessed their sins, and finally Bob admitted he was an alcoholic. First time he'd ever admitted it, even though everyone, of course, knew about it. And they prayed with him, and they worked with him, and he drank. He drank. So Bill calls Henrietta, and he says, I'm a member of the Oxford Groups. I need to find another alcoholic to talk to. She had the right one. She arranged for Dr. Bob. She phoned and said to Anne, Dr. Bob's wife, there's someone you need Dr. Bob to talk to. And Anne says, I'm sorry, he's asleep right now. He brought me a Mother's Day gift. It was May the 11th, May 12th was Mother's Day of 1935. And he's just tired. And as Bill says, what she didn't tell Henrietta was that he's flat asleep under the table of the plant that he had just brought for Mother's Day. She agreed they'd come on Sunday, the next day, Mother's Day, 1935. And Dr. Bob had a promise that he'd do it for Henry, as they called Henrietta, and they'd stay 15 minutes. They had supper. Bill said to Dr. Bob, you look as if you need a beer. Gave him a beer. This is a standard way of toning down, right? And then he starts to talk to Dr. Bob. And as Bill describes that talk, it was completely different from the way he had described it before. He had done it before. It was, for the first time, his need to talk to Dr. Bob that was paramount to him. It was no longer his need to teach anything to Dr. Bob, because, of course, Bob knew more than Bill did about the Oxford Groups. Bill had been part of the Oxford Groups for 6 months. That's how long he had been sober. Dr. Bob had been a member of the Oxford Groups for a year and a half. They were Christians. Dr. Bob read the big book, the Bible every day. He and Anne prayed every day. They prayed at the Oxford Groups. He knew much more about religion than Bill. He knew much more about, you get honest with yourself, you get honest with another human being, you make a restitution, those five sort of key concepts. He knew them all. And Dr. Bob, however, began to identify with Bill. He says in his story, this was the first person I'd ever talked to who knew from firsthand experience what I had been experiencing. He finally met someone who knew all the tricks, who had experienced everything he had experienced, who was the same as he, and yet who was different. I mean, that's the gift that each one of us has. I have experienced everything you've experienced, if you're like me, and yet I am different from what you are right now. And that's what Bill brought to him. Despair and hope. And it was from that Dr. Bob recovered. Dr. Bob didn't drink for about 3 weeks. Bill moved in with Dr. Bob and Ann. They talked and talked and talked and talked and talked because Bill was a big talker and Dr. Bob didn't have much business. did people think he was a pain in the butt? You can have that, John. take my joke, please. And then Dr. Bob said, you know, I think I feel well enough to go to a medical conference. Bill wasn't sure about that, but Bob said, no, I'm good. I feel good. I'm not going to drink there. Well, of course, he did drink. He drank a lot. And he had to be carried off the train by his nurse, and they were panicking. Did I tell you? I didn't tell everyone this. I told this in my Step 12 workshop. Yeah. I've been talking so much in sort of two different levels, the keynotes and the workshops, that it's hard for me sometimes to keep track of what I've said. Sorry. And Bill and Ann brought him home, and they sobered him up, and Bill drove him to the hospital because he had an operation that only he could perform that had to be performed that particular day. And as Bill gave him a bottle of beer to steady his nerves, and as he dropped Dr. Bob off, Dr. Bob said, Bill, I am going to go through with this thing. And Bill says, you mean the operation? And Dr. Bob says, no, this thing that we have been talking about. And Dr. Bob phoned after the operation, said it went okay, and then he didn't come home until about midnight. What had Dr. Bob been doing? He had been going up and down Akron, apologizing to people for the harm that he had done, telling them he was an alcoholic, talking to his debtors, dealing with his restitution, making his amends. From that day on, he did not drink. That was the day that AA was formed, when one alcoholic and another alcoholic got together. It's allegedly June 10th, 1935, although some historians believe it was the next weekend because the convention that Dr. Bob said he was at didn't take place on June the 10th. But anyway, whatever. That's when AA was formed, because at that point, one alcoholic had helped another alcoholic to recover. Now, what impelled Bill? It was not because he wanted to help others. It was because he wanted to keep sober. He didn't want to drink anymore. And that is what impels me. I don't want to go back to that fat slob who ate like a pig, disgustingly, who felt himself the butt of all jokes, although I suppose he was an object of pity to many, who was crummy to his wife, who was crummy to his kids, who was very self-absorbed and who would explode at a moment's notice if things didn't go his way, or might just resign and go into isolation because things weren't going his way. It didn't matter. I mean, either way. I don't want to go back there. And if I stop trying to help, I will go back there. Some people have a luxury that they can sit around and do nothing and just enjoy themselves. Lots of people have that luxury. Lots of normal people can dissipate themselves and just do nothing. But I can't, because if I do, I'll go back. And when I've done that, I'm ready. I'm almost there. I mean, I've gone through periods. In the last couple of years, I changed my work. I changed from being a litigation lawyer to being a mediator, a conflict resolution person. And my joke is that I expected it would take me about a year to get established. Well, I wildly exceeded my expectations. It took me about 2 years to get established. For about a year, I wasn't getting a lot of work. A year and a half, I wasn't getting a lot of work. And I was spending my time. I was trying to spend my time well, but there are a lot of times when, boy, that mouse just moved around and on the computer, and I was just sort of surfing around. And, oh, I think I'll see what's on the net, you know. I wasn't doing much, and it was a very scary time for me. I did a lot of step 10s during that time because I kept dealing with issues of self-worth. Maybe I'm no good at this. Maybe people really know the real me, and I'm not any good, and they don't think I'm any good. And why aren't people remembering how good I was or how nice I am? Or I mean, all these things, right? It was a very, very difficult time for me. And there were times when I just didn't do much. I turned on the TV. I moved from a law office to my home with a home office. Well, the TV set is there. The coffee's there, you know. I mean, I didn't overeat, but, you know, it was a dissipating time. Without doing Big Book workshops that I've done, I don't know what I would have done, really. I went to meetings. I had people I sponsored, but it's the Big Book workshops that really kept me, I think, going in many respects, because I did feel useful doing that. But I wasn't feeling useful in my work, and it's important for me to feel useful in my work. So I feel this so deeply. And I also am very aware that Dr. Bob said in his last major speech that we are guardians or trustees, he said, of our time, stewards of our time, guardians, trustees of our time. He said, when I spent 5 or 6 hours trying to carry a message to someone and I could have spent 1 hour doing it, then I wasn't keeping good account of my time. So he worked hard on carrying the best message possible. And I went to a Big Book study once where someone said, you may be the only copy of the Big Book the newcomer has ever read. And I don't think, it's not just a Big Book approach. You may be the only representative of a 12-step program dealing with compulsive eating that a person has ever met. What responsibilities do you owe to that newcomer, assuming you have recovered? Even if you haven't recovered, you might owe some responsibilities, but you're in a different position. But what are the responsibilities you owe? It seems to me that the responsibility I have, at any rate, I've decided that the responsibility I have is to carry the best message I can carry and to stop at that. And the best message I can carry is one that's simple, direct, explains the program, and makes identification so that a person can become hopeless and get hope. I mean, that's what Bill did. That's what Bill found worked. That's what Dr. Silkworth told Bill he should be doing, and that's the first time Bill tried it was with Dr. Bob. I urge you to think to yourself, can I explain who I am, what my history is, and what has got me out of that, how I have recovered? Can you explain that in 3 minutes or 5 minutes? I would love someday to go to a convention where 10 long-timers are put into an isolation booth or, you know, away, and one by one, they meet a newcomer. And the newcomer says, tell me about the program. And each one of these people describe, and I got to catch a bus in 5 minutes. Could you just tell me something about this program? And give them the opportunity to explain. I'd love to hear that, because I think you'd hear 10 different ways of carrying the message, one of which, two of which, five of which might be very helpful to you. You know? What I've discovered is that the approach that I have discussed is a very effective way of identification and so despair and hope. And I'll just tell you what I say. I'm not going to time myself, but I say, if I have a very short time, I have a problem with my body, an abnormal body, and an abnormal mind. That's what I've discovered about myself. My abnormal body is that when I start eating something, I can't stop. Not everything, but some things. I can't stop. And if I can give you a generic description of all my eating experiences, it's this. The hand holding a spoon, holding a fork, maybe just holding the food, and it's going to my mouth, and I'm eating, and my mind is saying, I've just got to stop. I must stop. This is terrible. I'm gaining weight. This is awful. I've got diabetes. I've got these illnesses. I just have to stop. And the hand is inexorably going from the food to the mouth, the food to the mouth. So I don't know if you've ever experienced that. I know people here have. No, I say this to you. I don't know if you've ever experienced that. Well, the chances are good that they will say, I've experienced that. They say, but that's not my real problem. That's what I discovered in this program. My real problem has nothing to do with that. Because if I knew the foods, if I could identify the foods that did those to me, because it's not every food, and I joke about radishes, but I use radishes as a good example, certain foods. And I say the one thing about OA that's different from AA is that you have to figure out those foods for yourself. Because what I can eat, maybe you can't eat, and vice versa. But if you've experienced that with some foods, then the most amazing thing I discovered in this program is that that's not my real problem. Because if I could identify those foods and I were sane, I would just wouldn't eat them. You know, I use the example of an anaphylactic shock. If I knew that shrimp would kill me or peanuts would kill me, I wouldn't eat shrimp. I wouldn't eat peanuts. I'd say, nice time I had with you guys, but no more. because you'll kill me. My real problem, I say, is that I have an abnormality of the mind. My mind is so clouded that I cannot remember at times that I have the abnormality of the body. My mind is so clouded that at times something persuades me that I can eat this stuff which I know consciously I cannot eat. And of course, once I start to eat them, I can't stop. But I can't stop from starting. And that abnormality of my mind is such that I can't stop. And then I say, here are excuses I've used to go back to eating. See if they make any sense to you. And I go on. I've given you my list already. I don't have my list memorized, but I'm standing up. It doesn't count. She's not looking. It's whole wheat. You know, whatever it is. All those. And I stress. I'm lonely. I'm sad. No one loves me, because very often that is something that people feel. At the same time, I say I'm happy. Too many people love me. Because that people have both those feelings, right? I'm no good. I'm too good. People don't recognize the goodness in me. People don't recognize the badness in me. They're too superficial. Whatever it is. I used to be attracted only to women who knew how bad I was and who weren't attracted to me, because they were the only ones smart enough to know that I wasn't any good. Kind of a pretty ridiculous path, but that's the case. But anyway. When I explain that, I say, let me tell you that what the 12 steps have done for me is to get rid of the mind problem. Once I did these 12 steps, I no longer had a clouded mind. I no longer have a clouded mind. I can look at the foods every time I see them that used to beckon to me, and I can say, you're poison, you're poison, and you're poison. Why would I eat poison? So that I can be around these foods and not want them. And then I talk about, you know, ice cream goes bad in my fridge. I tell the story about my wife and, you know, things like that. My wife eating half the chocolate, and I don't get angry, and I see where there's identification with that. And then I stop. And that's the program. I don't say things, because if you remember, Bill was for 6 months preaching how wonderful he felt. I am terrific. You know, I found God. I found emotional sobriety. I'm now a nicer person. You will find God if you work this program. And Dr. Sukla says, that's preaching. They don't want that unless you tell them that they're dead, that they're dying, right? Remember, that's sweetly reasonable as only the dying can be, that concept. You have to get them sweetly reasonable. You have to get them knowing that they're dying. So that's what I've learned from AA history. That if we don't carry this message of hopelessness, despair, powerlessness that's inherent in step one, and the message of hope, power in step two, then we're not going to get people to come. They're going to die. And they are dying. And I mean, the United States is the hotbed of obesity, right? The United States is the hotbed of huge portions and people walking around just overeating. Canada's on its way there, but we haven't quite made it. We're not quite as I don't think we're quite in your league, but certainly you know, you may be the greatest nation on earth. You're also probably the biggest nation on earth. Except maybe Tonga, where they prize overweight people. So you all walking around us, all walking everywhere, and everywhere in the world too, because I mean, poverty is not does not create thinness. Poverty, as a matter of fact, creates fatness, because the cheapest foods are the fattest foods, right? So you can be rich or poor, and you can still have this problem. All around us are people dying. And they're dying debilitating deaths. They're not just the people in this program, but they're the people all around us. And we have a message that can help them. And we have an obligation to carry the best message we can. The other thing, I 6 months after I recovered, I mean, I set my date of abstinence as May 1st of 1993. And as I said, it's approximate, but it's as good a day as any. It's around that time at any rate. When I first went through my plan of eating, I quickly identified the foods that were my problem. They were foods basically fat and salt and fat and sugar. for me, fat is a real problem. And by the way, I've talked to a number of people about their plan of eating, and I do encourage those of you who have been off sugar for a long time and off flour for a long time, the people who identify themselves as sugar and flour addicts, and if you haven't lost a lot of weight yet, or if you still find yourself with cravings, look at the fat issue. See whether there's also fat in the stuff that you haven't eliminated the fat. You may have eliminated all the desserts, but have you eliminated the fat? So I just encourage you to do that. But I'm not saying everyone has that problem. I'm just saying that's something that I've talked about with a lot of people today and in other places. But at any rate, those were my issues. So I eliminated a lot of all of, you know, fat and sugar and fat and salt, and I won't go into my food plan, my plan of eating, but I'd been absent for 6 months. I no longer wanted to eat the stuff that used to beckon to me. I was terrific, but I had lost no weight. I had lost very little weight. And my sponsor and I started, and I said to him, what kind, or maybe he said to me, I can't remember, what kind of a message am I carrying to say that I have recovered, which I had, from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body, but I still look as if I need this program. I still am fat. And I decided I had to re-examine my eating plan, my plan of eating, because I owe a duty to every compulsive eater who still suffers, I think, to achieve a healthy body weight. I'm not a normal body weight. I'm a healthy body weight. My doctor is completely happy with the weight I am. I'm not ultra thin, and for those on the tape, well, actually, I look like a god. for those on the tape, right, guys? Everywhere, right? Yeah. But you know what? I'm not, but I'm healthy, and I think I owe that to the compulsive eater who still suffers. So, you know, everything I set about, and I started to re-examine my plan of eating. And I found some eating behaviors I had to get rid of that were different from my food issues. And remember, I talked about that on Friday. And so I eliminated those eating behaviors and I lost my weight. A little while later, 11 years later, my doctor said there have been new studies. I think you have to lose some more weight. I lost some more weight. Re-examined my plan of eating. Because I want to keep healthy. I owe this to the compulsive eater who still suffers. So I take this, as you can see, deadly seriously. For me, there are people dying out there, and I'm one of those people. And I've got to tell you, I don't think I'm one of the best people for this, because I'm not a person, as I've said, who has suffered in the way that a lot of people in this program have suffered. I think there are a lot of people here who have to hear the message that only you and you can carry, and not that I can carry. I can help organize it. I've been trained as a teacher, and I've been trained to explicate texts, and goodness knows that's a wonderful gift that I've been given by my parents and the education and training I've had. But I cannot speak from the same kind of experiences that other people have. And they're just waiting for you. You know, they're just waiting. And they're waiting for OA to become better known, because we're not well known. And we have to start wondering about why it is that we're not well known. I heard a wonderful talk by a trustee once who said that his sponsor told him that if you are anonymous at the level below press, radio, films, television, and other public media communication, then you're in breach of tradition 11. You got to think about that. And you also got to think about the difference between anonymity and confidentiality. I'm not sure that we know that too well in this program either, because we sometimes equate anonymity with confidentiality. The trust that we have at a meeting is the trust of confidentiality. We don't tell what happens at a meeting, because that's the trust that we have. What you see here, what you hear here, keep here, right? Right. That's the essence. But that's confidentiality. Anonymity is the concept that we do not rise above other people by being publicly known as members of Overeaters Anonymous and press, radio, films, television, and other public media of communication. But what about other levels? You know, Bill Wilson never called himself Bill X or Bill W. He was Bill Wilson. But when Time Magazine wanted to put a picture of him, he wouldn't do it. When Yale or Harvard wanted to give him an honorary doctorate, he wouldn't take it. On his grave, well, you know the wonderful story, but he goes to see Dr. Bob on Dr. Bob's deathbed, and he says, you know, a group of people want to put together a real big mausoleum for you. And Dr. Bob says, no, I want to die like ordinary people. And if you go to the graves of Dr. Bob and Bill, you will see that not one mention is made of Alcoholics Anonymous on their graves. And if any of you ever saw that wonderful movie, My Name is Bill W., and you remember that James Woods played Bill Wilson right at the end. I mean, Bill was a hustler, and Bill was an egomaniac, and he admitted that he was. But right at the end, Bill's at an AA meeting somewhere, and someone said, hey, I haven't seen you here before. Where are you from? Oh, I'm from New York. Oh, have you met some of those old pioneers, some of the people who really started this program? And James Wood is truly a great actor, because for a 10-second clip, as I recall, you see every single emotion on his face, and yet it almost doesn't move. Should I tell him? Should I make myself into the? Should I tell him I am the founder? And he just says, "Yeah, I've met some." You know, it's that. It's that sense of that's the anonymity that we're. Yeah, and he wrote a wonderful article for Grapevine, the AA magazine. Why can't Dr. Bob and I be members of AA? Because he wanted just to be a member. And he was always at war with his other egomaniac mind, but he was doing his best to be humble. Anonymity is that. Anonymity is not making yourself better than anyone else or bigger or more important and not having the reputation of your program rest on you. That's anonymity. And yet, we are anonymous in so many other ways because we are embarrassed. So many of us embarrassed by our program. And why are we embarrassed by our program? Why, and I do mean to be slightly provocative. It says OA convention on all the signs here. How many overweight people have gone through this hotel in the last 3 days, never hearing about Overeaters Anonymous? Why doesn't it say, and I was challenged once at the same talk that this trustee gave, challenge, why doesn't it say Overeaters Anonymous Convention? Because we don't want people to know we're overeaters. Wait, where's Jim? Jim said someone at a treatment center he was at, someone would say to him, you know what, I'm a compulsive eater. And Jim would say, now everyone knows. You know? I mean, there are some of us who can hide it, you know, but most of us do not hide the fact. And it's not, you know, if someone sees a bunch of people at a convention, first of all, if they see a bunch of thin people at a convention and it's called Overeaters Anonymous, wouldn't that be great? If they see some thin and some fat, that's still great. So you think about it. What is our duty? What is the duty we owe? Now, we have heard in the past, I'm now going to become slightly offensive. I maybe just a provocative, but for me, the book really has a very clear message. And I think I said to the group at the Step 12 workshop in the Big Book study that I heard Sister Ignatius. I heard her a tape of her speaking, and Sister Ignatius was the person who worked with Dr. Bob in the what's the name of the hospital? What's the name of the hospital? No, Thompson was in New York, in Akron. Well, whatever the name is. I always forget the name. But whatever the name is, she worked in getting the drunks into the drunk area, even though they didn't want drunks. She would have a drunk ward. St. Thomas. St. Thomas, I think, yeah. And she worked with Dr. Bob, and she talked about how Dr. Bob was so selfless, and he was completely selfless. He provided help to alcoholics, 5,000 alcoholics in his lifetime. But every so often, Dr. Bob would say to her, kick this guy out. He's not interested. He's not really interested. That's an interesting concept. Kick this guy out. He's not really interested. There's a toughness there that we have not. We do not have in our program. We're nice people. We're nice. No, we are. We're nice people. Especially the comedians. Oh, especially the Canadians. That's right. No worries. That's right. That's right. It's true. It's true. We had, there's a joke that we had a prime minister who was very good friends with Ronald Reagan, and one of the jokes, cynical jokes in Canada was Ronald Reagan said he wanted a kinder, nicer nation, and Brian Mulroney gave him Canada. I don't want to get too political. That's just take it as a joke, okay? But we're all nice people, and we don't want to hurt people's feelings. And I told you my story last night about the woman who finally said to me, "How do you feel, really?" I did tell you that, right? And that was nice. You know, I mean, she was nice, but she was not nice in another way. She was confronting me. It was her intervention. And do we do that? How many people have we killed with our kindness? How many people do we kill by not having meetings that concentrate on the one message that we have in OA, which is that the steps are the way of recovery? Do we have meetings? As I had a meeting, I was responsible for a meeting that had no form to it. It just was a pickup meeting. Whatever you decide you want to talk about, you could talk about. It didn't talk about the steps if the person didn't want to talk about the steps. Do we have meetings that concentrate on things other than the steps? And if we do, what are those people who go to those meetings, what do they know about our program of recovery? I'm going to be really provocative and tell you that the tools of recovery are tools for recovery. They are not the method of recovery. You know, when I hear people say, "I was really upset, so I did a tool," I say, "What step were you on?" Because it's the steps that give us recovery, not the tools. The tools are a way to keep us from keep us absent while we're working the steps. But if we don't concentrate as a fellowship and say the steps are what give us recovery, we're losing the message of recovery to those who still suffer. How many of our meetings, and I've been to so many of them, are coffee clutches, are social get-togethers where we all just, well, I won't use the word, where we all just sort of talk about how bad we feel. You know? I mean, think about it. It's not as if, and I've got to tell you, I am not one of those who say positive pitches only, because I couldn't survive on that either. But I do say hope. Hope has to be in that room. And the hope doesn't have to be there just because there's a recovered person in the room. The hope can be there because there are a couple of non-recovered people who are working hard to recover, but who believe in this message. But a meeting that does not believe in the message of the 12 steps, that does not convey in some way the message of the 12 steps to recovery, is a meeting that is not conveying the message of recovery that it is its primary purpose. At least, that's my suggestion. I'm just tentatively putting it out there. Try to be nice again, yeah. I think a meeting should make anyone uncomfortable or bored if that person is just there for the social support or is there for dumping. I think it should make it uncomfortable not by saying, you know, we don't want to hear, you know, you don't want to hear anyone talk like this. I think it makes it uncomfortable by its very nature that it talks about recovery. And that there are people there who are vigilant to say, when I feel really crummy, I know that it's time for me to do a step 10. Or I used to feel really bad, but I worked those steps, and now I have a method by which I can deal with any problem. They're meetings in which the focus is on recovery, not on support. And yet we need support, but that's not what we're here for. There are organizations that give support in this world for compulsive eaters who still suffer, and maybe that's all people need. Some people only need that. The weight loss program that I went to, that I'm a three-time lifetime member of, each time I lost my weight, I gained more back because they gave me my foods back. They gave me all my binge foods back, and my one scoop became two scoops and all that. I thought I talked about that. But I'm a three-time lifetime member. It helped a lot of people who needed to know, 4 ounces is all I need of meat to eat. Oh, okay. I didn't realize how big 4 ounces was. I thought 4 ounces was this big. Now I know it's only that big. No, really. Some people just need that. They're not like me. They're not compulsive eaters like me. They're not people who suffer this dual problem of the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. I had a good friend who was really overweight, and he was a close friend. He was a friend of mine. And I would often talk to him about Overeaters Anonymous. Didn't have any interest in him. And he was my ophthalmologist, and I hadn't seen him for a year. And I went to my annual appointment, and in comes this man whom I did not recognize, a very thin guy. And when he opened his mouth, I realized, it's my friend. He's lost 70, 80 pounds. I don't know how much. I said, what happened? He said, well, I went to my doctor, and I said, I'm really overweight. What do I do? He said, well, tell me what you eat. And I told him what I ate, and the doctor said, stop eating cheese. You're eating too much cheese. So I stopped eating cheese. I mean, that person doesn't have my problem, right? And yet he was quite obese. So there are lots of people in this world who don't need Overeaters Anonymous. They don't need us. They may just need a guide to good eating and some support to help them get over the rough spots. And there are all kinds of programs that do that, both ones you pay for and ones that are non-profit. What do we offer that's different? We offer a message of recovery to people who suffer from what the Big Book calls the allergy of the body, but who suffer from an abnormality of the body. Let's not worry about words, right? Like Big Book thumpers will say, you got to use the word allergy, you got to use the word obsession. It doesn't mean the same things anymore, so sometimes it's more helpful to say abnormality of the body. An abnormality of the body, a physical abnormality, a disability that says that once I start eating certain things, I get uncontrollable cravings and my body takes over. And an abnormality of mind that keeps me convinced that I don't have that abnormality of the body. And does it in so many tricky ways that I can never keep track of it. That even if I'm steeled up against one aspect of it, it's going to get me another way. That I'm going to have these parallel paths, the Mickey Mouses, or the good Mickey and the bad Mickey, you remember? And maybe that's dating me too, I don't know. But the devil and the angel sitting on either shoulder, and one saying, well, I won't do Mickey's voice. I can't. My throat is terrible. But one saying, don't do it. It's bad for you. You're going to eat too much. You're going to explode. You're going to get diabetes. You're going to get a heart attack. Don't do it. Don't eat it. Don't eat this. And the other voice is simply saying, come on. Come on. Come on. Okay. You know, I mean, just bang. Just that's what happens. That's what we're here for. And if we stick to our purpose, we'll remember that. I've heard often it said that service is slimming in this program. And I'm living proof that it's not. Because while I was in relapse, I did a lot of service. And I can tell you, there's only one reason for service. There are two kinds of service. One is the service where we carry the message to the compulsive eater who still suffers. And the Big Book is clear that that can be done by people who have recovered, not people who haven't. You cannot give away that which you do not have. You can work with someone, as my friend and I. My friend and I, neither of us had recovered. He asked me to be my sponsor, to be his sponsor. Well, I hadn't yet recovered. I was on my path. But he was the one who showed me the path. And I was the one who worked with him because he had the AA. I told you this tonight. He had the AA background. I had the OA background. But he had the path. I didn't have the path. So he and I were able to work together, and we helped each other recover. So, you can always help someone recover even if you don't have the message, if you work together, but I cannot carry the message unless I have recovered. At least that's what the Big Book says. So that's the one kind of service. There's a whole other kind of service that is keeping OA alive. Why do we keep OA alive? We keep OA alive because it carries, its primary purpose is to carry the message the compulsive eater who still suffers. And keeping OA alive is important so long as OA carries that message. Because the steps have been given to us in some way, shape, or form through inspiration, love, God, whatever you want to call it. They're a gift to every single compulsive eater who suffers and who has recovered. And that gift is ours so long as we treat it well. And if we don't treat it well, some other group should come up and treat it with more respect. So the service we do to keep OA alive is not simply because we need to do service. I'm talking in terms of, I need to carry the message, that's for sure. I'll carry the message whether OA exists or not, because I still have to do it. But the service we do to keep OA alive is there to make sure that OA continues to perform its primary purpose. And so we have to make sure that every aspect of the service that we do keeps that primary purpose in mind, and that it doesn't become the service we're doing doesn't become the end in itself. You know? Pardon me? Right. Oh, okay. Thanks. Okay. Amen, brother. Right. Why do we need a treasurer? Well, I don't know. I mean, I'll tell you, in one of the groups that I've been part of, many of us for years didn't have a treasurer in our group. We didn't even count the money. When we had too much of it, we gave it away. We gave it to intergroup to distribute. We said if people are going to steal from us, that's their problem. You know? But sometimes you do need a treasurer, and you know, and it's sometimes important. Do we need an intergroup? Well, what's an intergroup for? The intergroup is what? To convey information from group to group? What's the purpose of the information? How are we doing our job? What are we doing to carry the message? Those of you who have been to, how many people have been to World Service Business Conference? Lots. I've been there lots of times. Have you ever wondered why an annual meeting of an organization, a business meeting of an organization, ever talks about all the things it does talk about without talking about really its main thing? What does an annual meeting do? How well did we do last year? What are we going to do this coming year? Isn't that what an annual meeting does? Do we do that at conference? We talk endless debates about commas and words. And we peripherally, not part of conference, but peripherally, we have meetings in which we discuss carrying the message. I've often wondered about that. I want to talk a bit in the time I have available to talk a bit about sponsoring. And I want to quote from the big book. The big book on page 98, the big book talks about carrying the message and whether a person should become dependent upon you for things. It is not the matter of giving that's in question, but when and how to give. That often makes a difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense. That's the shortest sentence in the big book. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence upon God. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. Now, that should tell us something about carrying our message. We should not become dependent upon other people for our recovery, nor should we allow them to become dependent upon us. I don't know if I'm a good sponsor or not. I know that I've sponsored a lot of people, and some of them have recovered and some of them haven't. But I know one thing. I don't work hard at being a sponsor, because it's really up to them to do the work, not up to me. If they want to see me, they phone me and make an appointment. I see them face to face. I can't stand telephones. It's just, as I said yesterday, if you telephone me, the chances are good. If I'm seated at the computer, there's something going on the screen and my hand is moving that mouse. If I'm in my kitchen, I might be doing the dishes. My wife would wonder about that. But I'll be wandering about. I may be looking at television with the mute on. You know, my eye has to be occupied. I'm that way. Sometimes I have to close my eyes in order to concentrate on what someone is saying. But meeting face to face, that's what AA is all about. I don't think I said it in the larger meeting, but in New Zealand, did I talk about New Zealand in the larger meeting or just in the smaller meeting? In the larger meeting, okay. So it's all face to face. It's all talking to someone. It's that hand of friendship. I say to a sponsee, you've got abstinent, you've got to work the steps. If you're at a race, I've said this as well, right? You're in a race with time. Have I said this? No, I haven't said this in a large meeting, so I'll say this now. What I say to sponsee when I work out a plan of eating with them, when they work out a plan of eating for themselves, I say, okay, you're abstinent. Right now, you're abstinent. If you're not working the steps quickly, you're going to go back. Your mind is going to bring you back to that food. So you'd better hurry and do these steps as quickly as you can. You're on a race. Your mind is racing with you. Either you're going to change your mind or your mind is going to change you. And you've got to work those steps quickly. And in that time, I will do anything I can to help you stay away from that food, because you've got to keep abstinent. You can phone me at 4 in the morning. My wife will understand. I won't like it, but I'll do anything. And if you phone me at 4 in the morning, I'll go for coffee with you. I'll go see you. I'll talk to you. I won't just sort of talk to you. If you need me to talk to, I'm there. If you want to phone me with your food, you can phone me with your food. But why don't you phone a newcomer with your food and help the newcomer as well as yourself? Because what do you need me to phone? I don't need you. You won't be doing me any good. You may be doing yourself good, but why don't you phone a newcomer? Or become buddies with someone who's just starting. But I'm there for you if you need me. If you've already eaten, phone me in the morning, and we'll figure out what mistakes you made that led you to this moment. And then we'll work it out. I've never fired a sponsee. A lot have left because I'm pretty boring. I don't listen to their problems. I say, that seems like a good problem to put down on step 4. Put it down on your list and deal with it. Because just telling me your problem is going to help you. And I can't give you any advice because I don't know what God has in store for you. I don't know what the answer is, and I'm not going to listen to your problem. We have steps to deal with your problems. So use the steps. So I don't do a lot of work. They have to tell me where we are in the big book, because I sponsor the big book. They have to tell me where they are. I say, I'm not your father. I'm not your mother. I'm not your confessor. I'm not your guide. I'm not your therapist. I'm not necessarily even your friend. I have one job to do, and that's to do my best to carry the message to the compulsive to you who is still suffering. That's my job. And as long as I do my job, you got to do your job. And if you keep coming to me with problems, I can't help you. If you want to talk about all the horrible things that are going on in your life, I can't help you. Only you can change your reaction to life. I cannot change it for you. So I don't work hard as a sponsor, and I don't keep track of anything. They have to do the work. So some of them fall off because they need more of a day-to-day kind of contact. And they want a contact of a friend. They're lonely. Some people are lonely. And I'm not there to deal with their loneliness. Let them figure out why they're lonely. Let them find out that through a spiritual awakening that they'll never be alone. Because that's the only way they'll really never be alone, is by becoming a member of OA, a real member of OA. You know that wonderful story in the back of the big book, Dr. Alcoholic Addict. No, not Dr. Alcoholic, the physician, Heal Thyself, where Earl, the physician, has been going to meetings for 6 months, and he meets with, I think, the carpenter, and he says, I don't know what's going on. The carpenter says, well, why don't you become a member of AA? He says, I've been going to meetings. No, I mean really a member of AA. Start to work this program. You know, then you're no longer lonely. What's the promise that's given to us in the big book with carrying the message? I mean, listen to this. Page 89. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. There are no musts. There are 54 musts in the big book. We know you will not want to miss it. Well, actually, there are 70 odd musts, but only 54 that are real musts. But anyway, we know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. You never have to be alone, even when you're by yourself, because you always have with you this, first of all, the fellowship, and you also have with you the sense of your higher power that gives you your real guidance. You no longer have to worry about what people think of you. All you have to worry about is what you think of yourself in relation to what you deeply believe in. And that's the core of what we're doing. I'm going to finish because my plane leaves relatively early, so I'm being whisked away by Deanna and Afifi. But I want to close. I wanted one other thing I wanted to say. there are meetings. I've been to some meetings where a whole bunch of people say, I'm a sponsor, but I'm not available to sponsor. And those are meetings of where people who sponsor are so busy. Their method of sponsoring, and I'm not calling it down because I have a lot of friends who do it that way, have a much more active role of sponsorship. So there's just a limit to how long they can, how many people they can sponsor. And I have, as I say, nothing against that other than one thing. If at those meetings there aren't enough sponsors to deal with newcomers, then I say you better start thinking about whether your method of sponsoring is really carrying the message to those who still suffer, or whether you're spending so much time with people who have already recovered that you don't have time for the people who are still suffering. And you've got to start thinking about whether your method of sponsoring is impeding the ability of the group to carry the message. So that's just a thought. Just provocative. I've got a lot of other provocations. And by the way, I've said this in my 12-step workshop, but if any of you ever want to know a bit more about sort of my approach to, not my approach, the approach I've been taught to the Big Book, there's a website, oabigbook.info, and you're more than welcome. There's all kinds of downloads there for free and stuff that you can get that might be of some help to someone. OA, oh, I'm not AA, OA Big Book, all one word, OA Big Book. .info about OA and Big Book. So it's. I want to close by saying this. Again, I can't thank you enough. It's a real privilege to be here. And again, you may be helping me much more than I may be helping you. I told you already that I don't ever want to be a star, and I mean that. I want to tell you an AA joke, which I think is very apropos of this. The AA speaker comes to a meeting and people give him a standing ovation, and there's a lineup after the meeting, people talking to him. Oh, you know, the way you interpreted that one paragraph, it changed my life. Thank you so much. Don't thank me, thank God. And another person comes up and says, you know, your particular point about the higher power, what a difference it makes. Thank you. Don't thank me, thank God. And a long-timer comes up to him and says, that was a really good speech. Don't thank me, thank God. The long-timer looks at him and says, it wasn't that good. So I want to leave you by just quoting the last two paragraphs of the Big Book. And I want to remind you that the word trudge, when I read it, does not mean walk with a purposeful step. You'll never find that in any dictionary whatsoever, whether written in 1937 or published now. Trudge means walk with a weary step. It's our disability that we must ever go forward. No, it's our disability that requires us ever to go forward. But the fact is, we're you'll hear. You'll hear what we're on the road to. It's page 164. It is the path of recovery. It is the path of joy, and it's just a lot of hard work, and it's worth it. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. No, I'm sorry. I last three paragraphs. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation, which you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you very much.